topics from ghostly spirits to amazing anomalies, covert technology, UFOs, and shadowy global events.
And that's right here at Revolution Radio, FreedomSlips.com, Saturdays, midnight till 2 a.m. Eastern Time. Revolution Radio, where information never sleeps.
Let the magic rise.
Hey everyone, it's Barbara Jean Lindsay, the Cosmic Oracle. If you have questions about your past lives or future plans, need answers from the cosmos about your love life or career, or just want to keep your finger on the pulse of the planet, check out my show, The Cosmic Oracle, here on Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com.
It is no secret that the so-called mainstream media is best described as controlled propaganda. Countless news stories are either totally ignored or spun with half-truths, and because of this, essential facts and vital information are often compromised. Join Dr. Ott every Friday night on Studio B at 10 p.m. Eastern and learn why The Story Behind the Story was nominated for a Peabody Award in its second year of producing unparalleled broadcasting excellence in 1997. That is, if you really care about learning the truth.
Thank you for listening to Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com. Any commercial advertising you may hear in this program is of the sole discretion and benefit of the host of this program you are listening to. Revolution Radio does not endorse any commercial products, nor does it accept monetary compensation for on-air advertising of commercial products, nor will it ever. We are and shall remain 100% listener supported. Any product advertising on this program are considered used at higher risk, and Revolution Radio shall not be held liable for any claims or damages received from any product advertised within this program. Revolution Radio, where information never sleeps.
The T-Ball program usually heard at this time will be momentarily delayed for a special broadcast.
Prepare yourself for a trip through time, space, and the reality that you have known. When you enter into Willow's world, Willow Andreasen brings you the thought-provoking dialogue and news from around the world that shows your mind has no limitations. Take it away, Willow.
Good afternoon and welcome from a beautiful United Kingdom. My name is Willow Andreasen, also known as Sari Sunflower, in the Revolution Radio at freedomslips.org chat room. And this is the Monday, the 24th of July, 2023 edition of Willow's World. Before I get started with telling you what's happening on today's show, I just want to say a big, big thank you to Dr. Jim Fetzer, who's just been on over the other side of a studio wall with today's The Raw Deal. And a big, big thank you to all the hosts here at the station for everything you all do. It's truly appreciated indeed. To the producers and moderators, who sometimes have a few challenges to tackle, but they do so promptly and with smiles on their faces. A big, big thank you to them. Also, huge outpourings of gratitude as well, and lots of love and hugs to the team I'm humbled and honoured to be a part of. A team that bends over backwards and beyond, and just that little bit more, to ensure that this station remains on air for close to 24/7 as we can get it, which is most of the time, and that is indeed the management team. A big thank you as well, and lots of love and hugs to Liz Ringley, who continues to represent so much to the station and always will. And also thinking of Liz and the family of Nighthawk, who of course today would have been his 59th birthday, so we are thinking of you as always, Liz, and also to Hawk's mum as well, and to all of Hawk's family, thinking of you today and always. And it is indeed down to Mike Ringley, to Nighthawk, that we have this amazing gift of a station. It was his vision, his drive, his prescience that convinced him it was a necessity to construct this vehicle for free speech, which took its maiden journey on New Year's Day 2011. We are a few months shy now of our 13th birthday. And in the past 13 years, this station has become a global family of like-minded souls, of kindred spirits who have gravitated towards each other and indeed been reunited with each other in certain cases as a result of this amazing gift of Nighthawks. And he is missed every single day. There's no joke. He is missed every single day. And we always wonder what he would have to say about what's going on in the world today. Well, we all could probably guess there would be a fair degree of disappointment. No degree at all in satisfaction of saying, well, I was right, wasn't I? We miss him every single day. So remembering you today and always, Hawk, thank you for being you. Also much missed as well, and I'm looking at his photographs to say this, huge outpourings of gratitude and lots of love and hugs and kisses to my late other half, Briareos, for everything that he continues to represent in my life and always, always will. Thank you very, very much indeed, my love. And also huge outpourings of gratitude as well and lots of love and hugs and kisses to some very, very special loved ones in my life. They know exactly who they are. They know exactly who they are. And to the musician, yeah, it's a bit of a challenging time right now, isn't it? But onwards and upwards, as they say. It's all we can do. And last but not least, folks, huge outpourings of gratitude to you amazing listeners. We do this for you. We wouldn't be able to do this without you either, folks. It's a totally symbiotic relationship. It's your kindness, your love, your support, your generosity that enables us to continue providing you with such a wide variety of shows hosted by fantastic individuals from all around the world on a close to 24/7 basis. It's that very same kindness, that very same love, that very same generosity, that very same support that enables us to do so on a commercial-free basis as well. Yeah, we have promos, of course we do, at the tops and sometimes the bottoms of the hour. But those promos are restricted to station business only, station information, station shows. And also, it's your love, support, kindness and generosity that enables us to continue providing you with the archives for free as well. And we don't take your support for granted, folks. We really don't, because we do truly appreciate just how challenging these times are for so, so many right now. We really do appreciate that. And you are continuing to support us through these times, for which we are immensely grateful indeed. A big, big thank you to you all. Thank you very much for being you. Now, as I mentioned, we are entirely listener-supported, folks. If you'd like to help us out and you're not sure how, what I recommend you do is you visit our website, which you can reach using one of three URLs. There's www.revolution.radio. That's www.revolution.radio. www.freedomslips.net. That's www.freedomslips.net. Or www.freedomslips.org. I'll repeat that, www.freedomslips.org. Any of those, you'll arrive upon this amazing website of ours, which has been established and lovingly maintained by the amazing Monster 383. So when you see him and my fellow managers in the chat room, please say a big, big thank you to them for what they do. Place you need to explore is the nav bar. That's the static bar of options remains there. Sedentary at the top of the homepage as you're scrolling down. So as I say, if you want to go and check something else out, like the donations, then you won't lose your place on the homepage because that'll open up in a new tab for you. So you click on that. We'll do that now. We'll click on that option there. Donations. Open up in a new tab for you. Details all the methods bar one of supporting the station. We've got Patreon. We've got Donor Box. We've got Direct Payment North America only. All three have monthly support options available with them. You need to be a patron in order to do so on Patreon, by the way. So you can become a patron either by selecting this option here on the donations page, or you'll find it on the homepage as well, sitting comfortably near the top of the page. Sitting pretty in pink, if you've got a light background. If you've got a dark background like me, it's a lovely leaf green. Donor Box is the alternative to PayPal. It's international in scope. It's easy to use. Again, you can set up something for regular monthly support, or you can use it whenever you are able to use it. Direct Payment North America only applies if you happen to live in the US or Canada and have a credit or debit card. Equally as easy to use. As Donor Box, but as I say, just restricted to North America only. We accept three different types of cryptocurrency, folks. They are Bitcoin, Ethereum, and Bitcoin Cash. I'll repeat those, Bitcoin, Ethereum, and Bitcoin Cash. There are QR codes on the screen. You point your devices at them, and you do your thing. And last but not least, the snail mail details, folks. Yep, we still accept checks or money orders, and they are to be made payable to Revolution Radio. That's two separate words. Revolution spelt R-E-V-O-L-U-T-I-O-N. I'll repeat that. R-E-V-O-L-U-T-I-O-N. And radio is spelt R-A-D-I-O. I'll repeat that. R-A-D-I-O. And they are to be mailed to the wonderful lady horse. Excuse me, Terry Ackerman. Sorry about that. Terry spelled T-E-R-R-Y. I'll repeat that. T-E-R-R-Y. And Ackerman is spelled A-C-K-E-R-M-A-N. I'll repeat that. It's A-C-K-E-R-M-A-N. And the mailing address is 1793. That's 1793 North Eden. Eden spelled E-D-O-N Road. That's Allen, A-L-L-E-N, Michigan, M-I, 49227. So checks or money orders made payable to Revolution Radio are then to be mailed to the wonderful lady horse, Terry Ackerman, at 1793 North Eden Road. And that's Allen, Michigan, 49227. Those details can also be found on the main homepage now. That's where I'm returning to. You can advertise on the station's website as well, folks. That's a way you can support us and also help yourself, too, if you've got a product or company you'd like to get out there. You want it to be seen by plenty, but cost is an issue. Well, it'd be seen by plenty on our website. You can advertise on our website for $25 a month. And for further details, you need to contact the GM, A Mad Painter, using the following email address, which is themadpainter13@yahoo.com. themadpainter13@yahoo.com. I'll spell out that first segment for you. It's themadpainter13. And I'll repeat that. It's themadpainter13@yahoo.com, all lowercase in format, by the way. We've got dedicated call to listen numbers for both studios, A and B, folks. The numbers you just call, you just listen. You don't have to participate. You don't have to speak. We heartily recommend, however, that you speak to your cell phone or landline service providers, because there are costs involved with calling those numbers. We don't want you getting any nasty shocks on your bill, so please call them first. Once you're happy with what you've been told, the dedicated call to listen number for Studio A is 641-793-6370. I'll repeat that, 641-793-6370. And the dedicated call to listen number for Studio B is 641-793-2531. I'll repeat that one. For Studio B, it's 641-793-2531. Don't forget to call your cell phone landline service providers first, okay? Check those costs out before you do that. And last but not least are the archives, folks. Yep, they're free to access, will be for the foreseeable. You can reach the archives either by selecting the archives option, which is third along on the nav bar, or going direct to its URL, which is www.revolutionradioarchives.com. That's www.revolutionradioarchives.com. And the details you need to access the wonders that await you within are the username and the password, both of which are lowercase and case-sensitive in format. The username is RevRadio. That's RevRadio. I'll spell that for you. It's R-E-V-R-A-D-I-O. And I'll repeat that for you. It's R-E-V-R-A-D-I-O. The password is ROCKS exclamation mark. That's ROCKS exclamation mark. I'll spell that for you. It's R-O-C-K-S exclamation mark. And I'll repeat that for you. It's R-O-C-K-S exclamation mark. Don't forget that exclamation mark, folks, because without it, you won't be able to get in. I know that. I omitted it once. And guess what happened? Nothing, because I omitted it. Remember it. You'll be perfectly fine, though. But again, a big, big thank you to everyone for your continued support. We are truly, truly grateful indeed. Thank you. So what's happening on today's show then? Got a lot packed in today, actually. A lot, as always. I'm going to wander into the chat room first to say a big hello to everybody in there and make sure everybody is okay. And then we're going to be commencing with today's Geek Headlines, which is coming courtesy of the Nexus of Nerdom. This is IO9 Gizmodo's morning spoilers, posted up today, actually. All fresh and sparkling. Following that with the Gallivant's Rude Geekery, that is the Monday afternoon geek out. I've got three articles to start with, maybe more, don't know. We'll see what else. But the first one, well, actually, all of them are from Den of Geek. The first one is, we're taking a trip in the TARDIS and temporarily traversing into the Hooniverse to ask whether returning showrunner Russell T. Davis will be acknowledging former showrunner Chris Chibnall's timeless child storyline within his own future stories. Well, from what I've read so far, yes, he probably is. Anyway, carrying on. Also, as I said, all of these are from the Den of Geek. So this one, next up, deferred from Sunday, 2nd of July, 2023, Sunday show. Well, obviously, because I've just said Sunday, isn't it? We're journeying to the world of cinema and settling down with a big box of popcorn for the Den's estimations of what it considers to be the most spine-chilling scenes from a wide variety of 1980s movies. And they're not necessarily horror movies either. Finally, all staying with the Den of Geek, we're remaining in the world of cinema as well to learn more about Have You Got It Yet? The story of Syd Barrett and Pink Floyd, which is Mercury Studios' new documentary on one of the world of music's greatest of collectives. The second hour is commencing with the penultimate of a selection of poetry celebrating the summer in Willow's Poetic Ponderings, after which the doors are open to the sultry snuggery that is the Poetry Corner. It's not quite so sultry today, but you get the drift anyway. Born in October 1902 in, well, we actually, as I say, first, we're returning to the world of 20th century American poetry. For a study of one of its most personal of literary talents, he was born in October 1902 into an African-American family. His father was a building contractor and his mother was a school teacher. The family moved to the West Coast and settled in Los Angeles when the poet was 3 years old. Educated in public schools, he enrolled at the Pacific Union College in Anguin, California, graduating with a Bachelor of Arts degree in English in 1923. He entered the world of academia thereafter, moving to the East Coast and settling in New York after accepting a position at the Harlem, or which is now Northeastern Academy. His first poem, Hope, was published in the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People's magazine, The Crisis, the same year, and he continued to publish his poetry regularly thereafter. During his time in New York, he met and befriended fellow poetic contemporaries, notably Langston Hughes and Claude McKay, and became a noted name within the Harlem Renaissance movement. The poet married Alberta Johnson in 1926, and the couple would go on to become parents to six children. In 1931, the poet and his family relocated to Huntsville, Alabama, where the poet taught in Oakwood Junior College for 3 years. The early 1930s saw the poet expanding his literary oeuvre to encompass the authorship of fiction and children's books, some of which, although critically acclaimed, were deemed controversial in nature too. His friendships with African-American intellectuals and authors, and his refusal to censor and destroy his private records, led to the poet's dismissal from Oakwood in 1934. The poet returned to California, where he wrote his most famous novel, the highly acclaimed Black Thunder, which was published in 1936. The family relocated to Chicago the same year, with the poet teaching at a number of educational establishments. The late 1930s and early 1940s saw the poet focusing on works aimed at the younger reader, and in 1943 he gained his Master of Arts in Library Science from the University of Chicago. In 1944, the poet became the head librarian at Fisk University in Nashville, Tennessee, where he remained until his retirement in 1966. Post-retirement saw the poet taking on positions at both the universities of Illinois and Yale and working on literary collaborations with Jack Conroy and Langston Hughes. The poet passed away from a heart attack at his home in Nashville on 4th of June 1973, aged 71. Highly respected during his lifetime and recognised as one of the leading voices in African-American literature, his most notable works included his and Langston Hughes' collaborative children's novel from 1932, Popo and Fifina. He was born in Alexandria, Louisiana. His name was Anna Bonton. The remainder of the show sees us circumnavigating our wonderful planet to explore some of its most stunning of locations and to remember a beautiful body of water that was lost to the years. The first article journeys to 11 abandoned cities renowned for their history and archaeological wonders. And the second and final article travels to the Middle East to learn about the largest inland body of water that was known in its time as the Paratethys Sea. So, got plenty to get on with. Going to wander into the chat room now, say a big hello to everybody in there, make sure everybody is fine. Apparently, I met somebody in a dream last night. I was wearing a big sun hat. It was hot outside. I don't know. I don't ordinarily wear a sun hat, but I would, I suppose, if somebody gave me one, I suppose. But it's nice to know I'm wandering during the night. Nice to know I'm wearing a sun hat. It's nice to know where I've been as well. I'd like to go to that part of the world. Anyway, who's in there? Let's see who is in there. I don't want to miss anybody out. So let's see. Jim Jones is in there as well as Comet. Popsicle Toes is in as well as one of our fabulous hosts, which is Mona. Mona, of course, is the host of Adventures of a Feral Hippie, which is on over the other side of the studio wall at the moment. Just making sure I'm not missing anybody out. Pat Rabbit's in the chat room as well. Patrick, of course, is one of our fabulous managers. He's also the host of Not for Public Consumption, which is on Studio B on Thursdays at midday Eastern. Net Effect is in as well. I don't want to miss anybody out. I'm going to go to the top of the hour. Fleeced is in. He's in the chat room as well as Feeds, who Feeds is something that lets us know what's going on in there. Wonderful manager that is Mr. Rowan is in the chat room. He's got three offerings on this very studio. Folks, he's on Sundays at 5 p.m. Eastern with the Row Lounge. Two 4 p.m. offerings. He's on a couple of hours, actually. Less than that now. After me here with Crypto Corner. Tuesdays is Rose Corner. He's also on Studio B on Thursdays at 8 p.m. Eastern with Reality Extraction. I've gone up to the top of the hour now. Let's just say, let's see who else is in. I don't want to miss anybody out. No, I think I've got everybody. Yeah, I've got everybody. If you want to come in and see, get in the chat though, folks, please do come in. It'd be good to see you in there. The more, the merrier. It'll be good to see you. So, excuse me, I'm just going to take a sip of water. Hold on. Thought I'd blow my nose while I was at it as well. So, we're going to start today's proceedings by heading over to the Nexus of Nerd and his IO9 Gizmodo for today's Geek Headlines, which of course is their morning spoilers, posted up today. In fact, only about 3 hours ago, compiled by Gordon Jackson and James Whitbrook, and it's headlined, The Witcher is ready to make Ciri its main character after season 3. Plus, Simon Pegg teases dire stakes for Mission Impossible Dead Reckoning Part 2. So Blue Beetle director Angel Manuel Soto discusses his inspirations. Ben Wheatley talks up a monster budget for the Meg 2. Plus, a tiny new look at Disney's Percy Jackson and the Olympians, and what's coming on Riverdale and Outlander. So spoilers away, we start with Mission Impossible Dead Reckoning Part 2. So during a recent interview with Cinema Blend via Collider, Simon Pegg suggested his character Benji may not survive the events of Dead Reckoning Part 2. Here's a quote. I think that there's something that has always been the case, but no more, sort of. Clear is it in these stories that we, as I think Luther says, we don't matter as much as a mission. And any one of us at any time could face the end. And if that happened, I'd be sad. He's been in my life for 17 years. I've watched him, been him, growing up, becoming an older and more mature agent. And it's kind of they live a sort of tragic life in a way. Next is Blue Beetle. So in conversation with Movie Maker magazine, Blue Beetle director Angel Manuel Soto revealed the film is heavily inspired by the 1960 magical realist film Macario, in which a woodcutter is visited by the devil, god and death on Halloween night. So here's a quote. Well, here's some quotes from it. I practice a religion called Yoruba. It's an Afro-Cuban religion that has roots in Christianity, but it's mainly an African religion. It's something that I grew up with by proxy from my mother. I love reading about science and metaphysics and spirituality. I think it's something that's super important to explore on your own. I love learning about all religions and faiths and all different denominations. Every religion offers respite or a solution to the reality of death. And Blue Beetle, spoiler ahead, explores an afterlife that's astounding and moving. It is inspired in part by one of cinematographer Gabriel Figueroa's shots in the 1960 film Macario, a film I deeply love. The magic realism of Macario stuck with me. When we were developing that scene, I was like, man, why don't we pay homage to the movie that built us? Why don't we pay homage to the movie that we can say is Latin cinema? Macario's magic realism is beautiful and it's smart, like it is in Latin literature, and it's ours. Next up is the Meg 2, The Trench. So Ben Wheatley also stated he wanted every dollar on screen for the Meg 2 in a new interview with Total Film magazine. Here's a quote. "By the time I got to the Meg, I'd done a lot of effects work, and I had an inkling of it. And because of the pandemic, I had an extra 6 or 7 months, so I storyboarded the whole thing, every frame of it. So when we came to start it, there was a massive amount of prep that had been done. I don't like the idea of these tales of people making it up on the day. I wanted every dollar on screen." Next is the Venture Brothers' Radiant is the Blood of the Baboon Heart. So Brock Samson clashes with Red Death in a new clip from the Venture Brothers movie. Indeed he does. If you don't want to be spoiled, don't look at it. Justice League Warworld is next. So Batman becomes a Hollow Earth mercenary in a new clip from Justice League Warworld. Again, if you don't want to be spoiled, don't look at it. Next up is Mortal Kombat Legends Cage Match. So Johnny Cage must rescue Dirty Dancing's Jennifer Grey from a doomsday cult in a new trailer for Mortal Kombat Legends Cage Match. Indeed he does. Oh, there's plenty going on today. Witchboard is next. So we also have a teaser trailer for Chuck Russell's Witchboard remake releasing next year. Plenty going on. Wow. Quantum Leap is next. So TV Line reports Melissa Roxburgh, Francois Arnault, Aaron Abrams and PJ Byrne will guest star in the second season premiere of Quantum Leap. According to the outlet, the episode will see Ben in the body of a man named Perez on a plane in 1978, flying somewhere over Russia. Scared, frustrated, and cut off from the Quantum Leap headquarters, Ben has no choice but to proceed with the leap on his own. Perez's cohorts, played by Roxburgh, Arnault, Abrams and Byrne, are down-and-out members of the Air Force, tasked with a secret mission to transport a mystery crate to New Delhi. However, the plane is shot down by missiles before they can reach their location. Whatever is being delivered in that giant crate is extremely important, because Roxburgh's character risks her life, and Ben's, to get it off the plane before the plane explodes. Next up is The Witcher. So during a recent interview with Yahoo News, co-executive producer Tomek Baginski confirmed Ciri will become the new main character of The Witcher after season 3. So here's a quote. "So I think this is very exciting to do, but especially for Freya. This is also the book, Time of Contempt, where Ciri, let's be blunt about this, becomes the main character of the saga. Because this is how it was done in the books. And watching Ciri evolve, and watching Freya evolve as an actress in this season, was incredible. Just incredible." The Continental from the world of John Wick is up next. So Coming Soon reports the upcoming John Wick spin-off series premieres this September 22nd on Peacock. Percy Jackson and the Olympians is next. So Percy Jackson News has a new look at Grover, Percy and Annabeth as they appear in their upcoming series at Disney+. Riverdale is next. So the Archies get swept up in Cold War propaganda in the synopsis of the August 9th episode of Riverdale, which is called For a Better Tomorrow. So here is that synopsis. As the gang gets swept up in Cold War paranoia, a new mystery brewing in Riverdale leads Jughead, played by Cole Sprouse, to suspect it may have ties to a string of suspicious murders in town. Archie, played by KJ Aper, reconsiders his future after Uncle Frank, played by guest star Ryan Robbins, gives him a hard time about his poetry writing, and a shocking discovery involving her family shakes Betty, played by Lily Reinhart, to her core. Camilla Mendes, Madeleine Petch, Madge and Amick, Casey Cott, Charles Melton, Vanessa Morgan and Drew Ray Tanner also star. Greg Smith directed the episode, written by Ted Sullivan and Greg Murray. Nancy Drew is next. So Ryan rushes to Nancy Drew's aid in the synopsis for The Sinner's Sacrifice, her August 9th episode at the CW. Here we go. Synopsis time. Ryan, played by Riley Smith, shows up just in the nick of time to help Nancy, played by Kennedy McMahon. Meanwhile, Nick, played by Tunji Kasim, is thrown by a statement George, played by Leah Lewis, makes. And lastly, Bess, played by Madison Jaizani, is left feeling concerned after speaking with Ace, who's played by Alex Saxon. Melinda Sue Taylor directed the episode, written by Alex Torb and Leilani Terrell. And finally, Outlander. Jamie goes to war in the trailer for this week's episode of Outlander. So, busy one today. Busy one indeed. I'll just share that one there in the chat room. For everyone. There we go. I'll share in both rooms. What do I feel about The Witcher? Well, if it's in the books, it's in the books, but we'll see. So let's have a quick look at Kotaku, shall we? The headlines today on Kotaku. Xbox just got a huge library of classic retro games. It looks like Armored Core 6 will have six-player multiplayer. Every Street Fighter game ranked from worst to best. PlayStation 5 handheld looks even goofier than expected in leak. Diablo 4 Twitch streamer starts season with permadeath after 50 hours. And still with Diablo 4, fixing bad menu after fans kept accidentally buying Battle Pass. Nintendo post Yono Sidon simps are screaming, crying and throwing up. Every big anime announcement at San Diego Comic-Con as well. Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, Mutant Mayhem, Xbox controller smells like actual pizza. I've got time for that one, I'm going to go back to it. Blizz on Diablo 4 uproar, won't do a patch like that ever again. Star Wars Outlaws will feature Tatooine because we'll never escape that place. This is what the trending ones here. Halo fan tricks enemies into dying hilariously on new map. I'm going to be talking about that one next week. Despite advancements, games still aren't doing enough to stop toxic voice chat. This Nintendo franchise doesn't sell and Shigeru Miyamoto has a theory. And Baldur's Gate 3, which version of the Mega RPG should you get? I mean, it's been trending for about a couple of weeks now. As I say, the Halo one I'm going to be talking about next week. But if I've got time, I'm going to go back to... I'm just drawn to this one, which is the controller that smells like actual pizza. I mean, it's... just drop it in some pizza. I think that'll probably do it. Spray it with pizza. Well, no, I don't know. They'll find out. I'm sure we might have time to go back to it, maybe. It's just one of those curious headlines. You know what I'm like. If there's a curious headline like that, I'm drawn to it. Like a moth to a flame. So I'm just going to look at it if I can. But first, we've got the three articles from Den of Geek, which I'm going to read. And I mean, I can already answer this one about the Timeless Child. I mean, Rusty D's already said he's going to be making reference to the Flux and the 60th anniversary specials anyway, so... we'll see. Because as far as I'm aware, I seem to remember Rusty saying that he actually liked it. And in fact, it's canon, but I'm not going to get into that dispute again now. You've heard me talking about it enough. Let's look at the article, which has been authored by Chris Farnell. It was posted up on July the 12th. And, yeah. So, it asks, should Russell T. Davis acknowledge the Timeless Child? Ignore it, treat it as an unalterable fact, twist it. How should the new Doctor Who episodes deal with a controversial part of Chris Chibnall's legacy? It's not that controversial. It goes back in. It was in the original series. It was very much, you know, in the classic series, it was hinted at that the Doctor was something a bit more exceptional than a normal Time Lord. Let's just put it that way. Also, look up the Cartmel Master Plan. Tells you a little bit there as well. So the legacy of Chris Chibnall's reign as Doctor Who showrunner is a controversial one, and even now it's unclear how history will judge it. Chibnall brought in a lot of important and necessary steps in the show's evolution, including the first woman Doctor, the first non-white Doctor, the first non-white writer on the show, and a real attempt to bring back the educational aspect of the series for the first time in decades. There were also things some fans were sceptical about. For many, the resolution of the giant Flux arc left something to be desired. The destruction of Gallifrey for the second, or possibly even third time, depending on your personal canon. Cybermen with giant frilly Time Lord collars. But the biggest controversy, without a doubt, has been the story arc known as the Timeless Child. So what is the Timeless Child? Well, if you've listened to this show enough, you'll know exactly what the Timeless Child is, but... for those who are new and tuning in and those who are uncertain, here's a description. So for those that need reminding, the Timeless Child was a story arc that revealed the Doctor had a hidden past. Previously, it was thought that the Doctor was a Time Lord on her 15th life, or 13th numbered incarnation, plus John Hurt's War Doctor from the 50th anniversary special, plus a second David Tennant incarnation in the two parts of A Stolen Earth Journey's End, the first of which was played by William Hartnell in 1963. Talking about that's the very first that we see, anyway. And in fact, we're on to our third David Tennant incarnation now, aren't we? Anyway, back to the article. The Timeless Child twist revealed that the Doctor had other lives before Hartnell. These included the Morbius Doctors, a series of mysterious faces seen in the story The Brain of Morbius, when the fourth Doctor was having his mind read, revealing images of himself, the third, second and first Doctors, and other faces besides. It also included the Fugitive Doctor, played by Joe Martin, who travelled in a TARDIS shaped like a police box and was on the run from the Time Lords, although we saw that she performed a few black bag operations for them in the past. It also included an as-yet unnumbered variety of previous identities, many of them children. It turns out that the Doctor is not a Time Lord, but a member of an unknown species, found as a child, alone at the edge of a gateway to another universe. The Time Lords learned the art of regeneration from that child and raised her to be their secret agent. Then when she went on the run, they wiped her memory and made her regenerate back into William Hartnell as a child, safe in the assurance that they would never run away again. Whether it worked or not, the Timeless Child arc was aimed at carrying out several practical functions. One, it gave the Doctor back some of their air of mystery, once more making her a traveller in time and space with an unknown origin. Two, it bailed most of a backlog of continuity associated with the Time Lords, who were always a bit of a cumbersome element of the show, although arguably Davis did this perfectly well with the Time War. Three, most importantly, it retconned the Doctor so that they were not an old white dude who, for reasons unknown, had suddenly become a woman, but in fact had a long history traversing every gender and ethnicity. Some fans didn't like it for precisely that reason. There is definitely a portion of fans who like Doctor Who while remaining willfully ignorant of all the principles the Doctor stands for. There's no getting around the fact that some people are bigots who think the Doctor is a timeless alien intelligence who for some reason must always be a posh British white dude. But ignoring those people, some people dislike the twist as an unnecessary hat on a hat. After all, the Doctor is the one who runs. Previous attempts to reveal the great mystery of the Doctor's backstory, like the unrealised other plotline from story editor Andrew Cartmell during the Seventh Doctor's era, or the hybrid storyline from Stephen Moffat, have also fallen by the wayside mainly because, whatever the Doctor's history is, they always become a much more boring character when they start worrying about it. The Doctor being a Time Lord has been a part of a character long enough now that it just sort of sticks. It's one of those things everyone, even non-fans, just know about the Doctor. So changing that feels unfair. So now that Russell T. Davies has come back, and fans are eagerly forgetting all the complaints they made about him the first time around, there are people hoping he will simply make it so that it never happened. I think you're going to be disappointed there, folks. That's all I'm going to say about that. I mean, I've said before, and I'm going to say it again, I'm absolutely thrilled with the Timeless Child reveal. I think it makes perfect sense. The Doctor's a pretty integral figure. Why is it the Time Lords are afraid of a Doctor? So, anyway, back to the article. So, yeah. First option is the unhappening of a Timeless Child. So Chris Chibnall himself has gone on the record as expecting Davies to negate his big twist, saying, "Oh, I fully expect Russell to ignore it." So could Davies do it? Could he simply wave a hand and say, "No, the Doctor's actually still a Time Lord now"? It's not completely far-fetched. Doctor Who is the longest-running science fiction series in history. Except it's also not. Even before the show was cancelled in 1989 and reborn in 2005, Doctor Who has always been a succession of different shows, with their own aesthetics, values and storytelling interests, and even, to a certain extent, their own continuity. The first Dr. William Hartnell's Taking School Teachers Through Time and Space to Learn About History and Science show is not the same beast as the second Dr. Patrick Troughton's Bug-Eyed Monster of the Week series, and both are wildly different from the third Dr. John Pertwee's Bond-esque adventures. As Chibnall told RadioTimes.com, you're not carrying a vase across a room. You've got to get in there and say what you want about the show, the character and the world, adding, it's one of the few drama series without a written Bible, and every era contains a contradiction or left turn from what has come before. Any future showrunner will ignore it or run with it. For starters, this wouldn't even be the first time Russell T. Davis personally has disregarded an unpopular pronouncement about the Doctor's species. Between the classic series cancellation and Davis bringing Doctor Who back, there was the ill-fated Doctor Who the movie starring Paul McGann, which announced that the Doctor was half-human on his mother's side. Davis happily ignored this from the outset, making several references that contradict that plot point out of existence, even as Paul McGann was preserved as a legitimate incarnation of the Doctor. Just as with the half-human twist, Davis doesn't have to walk into the office on day one and announce bollocks of a timeless child. With the 60th anniversary underway, Donna Noble returning and the 14th Doctor suddenly looking like David Tennant again, the Doctor is going to be busy from the outset. It'll be no surprise if it's a while before the Doctor even has time to think about his origins. Maybe halfway into Shooty Gatwa's first season, he can introduce himself as the Time Lord and a certain segment of fans can breathe a sigh of relief while another segment can start angrily tweeting about it, assuming we still have Twitter by then. And even then, he can still be a Time Lord by adoption, allowing those fans who enjoyed the twist to preserve their headcanon without it interfering with the plot of the show. But all of this is making a very big assumption, a whopping huge one to be honest, and that is that Russell T. Davis agrees with that loud subsection of fans. And if there is one thing you should know as a Doctor Who fan of any stripe, it is that you should not trust Davis to agree with you on anything. So what if RTD leans into it? There is, all around, a kind of general assumption that Russell T. Davis will mostly ignore any dangling threads from the Chibnall era to focus on his own story ideas. As said, Doctor Who is a succession of different shows, and a new showrunner normally marks one of those historic cut-off points. But Russell T. Davis's priorities have always been to tell the story he wants to tell, and, with Doctor Who especially, to appeal to as wide an audience as possible. What fans want appears to be a distant third on his list, and even then that is assuming that fans is some sort of monolith block of opinion rather than an ongoing many-splintered argument where any two people will hold three contradictory opinions between them. Indeed, on the record, Davis has very much supported Chibnall's big twist, writing in his preamble to the publication of his Doctor Who and the Time War chapter during lockdown. But now, the 13th Doctor is shown as Doctors galore, with infinite possibilities. So the question is, can Davis use the timeless child? One of the few bits of dialogue we've got from the trailers for the 60th anniversary specials is the Doctor saying, I don't know who I am anymore. Now, of course, that could refer to any one of a million different things, including it being the Doctor or actual amnesia. But you wouldn't be crazy for thinking it refers to the timeless child twist. Maybe the Doctor has ideas about where the timeless child actually came from and who their people were. Maybe he has some brilliant ideas about what those hidden incarnations of the Doctor got up to before Hartnell. Maybe he even knows why the TARDIS was a police box long before it turned up in Totter's Lane scrapyard in the timeless child. It certainly seems unlike the Davis we have known before, who wanted a Doctor who was always moving forward, and who kept his fanish speculations to himself while making sure the series skipped continuity questions in favour of what is happening right now. But Davis has been gone a long time, during which he's evolved and grown as a storyteller, and also is no longer trying to make the argument that Doctor Who can be mainstream and successful when so many shows, Loki, Timeless, Legends of Tomorrow, have not just tried to mimic Doctor Who, but mimic his version of Doctor Who. So what should he do? Personally, says the author, I'm the worst sort of fan. Despite everything I know about Doctor Who in particular and storytelling in general, I still cling to the fantasy that the show is one long story, where all the pieces fit together in a way that sort of makes sense if you squint. It is one long game of consequences. And part of that is that anything that happens stays happened, apart from the half-human bit, because we all agree that's rubbish. So, like or loathe the Timeless Child, it's not Russell T. Davies' job to fix that plot element, only to push on forward with the story to tell us what happens next. So, I think it was a fabulous introduction. I think it's, as I said, it was heavily signposted in the classic series anyway, that the Doctor was not just standard Time Lord, and in fact had something to do with its origins all along. So, there we go. I'll post that there in the chat room. What I'm going to do, because I'm not sure how long this article is going to be. So I'll go for Pink Floyd one first, I think. And then I'll have a look. I may not be able to go into the scariest movie scenes in depth, but I can certainly tell you which ones they come from and give you some highlights. So anyway, from Den of Geek, this one, authored by Tony Sokol, posts up on July the 14th, and it's about a legendary Pink Floyd, it's about a new Pink Floyd documentary. And so a legendary Pink Floyd mythology finally confirmed in this new documentary. So it's about Pink Floyd founder Syd Barrett, mainly. And it's shedding new light on a legendary moment from the band's history and one of their biggest hits. So Pink Floyd is best known as the band whose Dark Side of the Moon broke all records as the longest charting album in rock history. Dozens of their songs are classic rock staples. The feature-length film of their rock opera The Wall is a cult classic, and their sound is as instantly recognisable as their enigmatic backstory. Have You Got It Yet? The story of Syd Barrett and Pink Floyd is co-directed by Roddy Bagoa, the filmmaker behind Taken by Storm, The Art of Storm Thorgerson and Hypnosis, and Storm Thorgerson, a Pink Floyd intimate who started a graphic arts team which illustrated the band's most iconic album covers. But the band's founder and guiding light, Syd Barrett, dimmed in the glare of the spotlight, leaving the group after their second album, long before they achieved the stratospheric success their later work would bring. The feature-length documentary attempts to polish the rougher spots, and during the filming, Bagoa uncovered a true gem. Barrett's unannounced June the 5th, 1975 visit to the Abbey Road Studios during the Shine On You Crazy Diamond recording session remains a large part of the Pink Floyd mythology. The band was on the tail end of recording their ninth studio album, Wish You Were Here, working on the final mix of a song they'd written to the musician history was deemed broken by psychedelic excess. The coincidence seems improbable, but all in a day's work for Pink Floyd. There is, however, photographic evidence which subverts much of the accepted narrative. It can only be seen in Have You Got It Yet? We've got some images of Syd that no one's ever seen in the film from that Shine On session, Bagoa tells Den of Geek. There's only been one or two images that have been around. The exclusive photos found in the film are a stark contrast for two which leaked from the session. Available images which capture the band's founder along with Roger Waters, Dave Gilmour, Richard Wright and Nick Mason appear to show the spent shell of a former genius. Barrett's head and eyebrows are shaved and he put on weight. That's the one that's always been reproduced. I didn't use it in the film because I think he's play-acting, Bagoa says. He's sticking his stomach out, turning to emphasise it. When I look at that, I think he's doing it to be funny. One of the things that comes up a lot is that he was more aware of everything around him than is written. Bagoa wanted to debunk and confirm the many misconceptions surrounding Pink Floyd. Some myths persist because audiences are guided by what they hope to be true. Others are the perceptions forced on Syd by people who knew fragments of a larger story. The extent of Barrett's mental breakdown is as open to interpretation as the lyrics of his songs. It's a big question, Bagoa admits. One key was a catalogue of the things sold from his house when Syd died. He had artist easels and tables where he hammered on extensions to make them taller. One of the stories repeated in every book and film is some neighbour saying, I would hear him banging his head on the wall in the middle of the night and screaming like a dog. When I saw the pictures from his house, I thought, hang on, he was building stuff. The singer, songwriter and guitarist was also a naturally gifted painter known by his given name Roger Barrett. He returned to the visual arts after the combination of mind-expanding chemicals mixed badly with the demands of growing fame. The accepted narrative is Sid was a recluse living in a dingy apartment in Chelsea, West London for years after Gilmour moved from second guitarist to the group's lone guitarist in 1968. Barrett may have quit Pink Floyd, but hadn't truly abandoned his musical career, and the other members of the band pushed him to keep up a pop artist's pace in his experimental solo work. When I look at the timeline, the fact that he did Madcap last and Barrett in the same year, how compressed the amount of music that happened, it's astonishing, Bagawa says. He made two full LPs in the same year. There's not a lot of bands that do that. Released on March 1st, 1973, Dark Side of the Moon landed Pink Floyd in a new stratosphere. While looking for direction to a follow-up, the musicians revived an earlier conceptual project using unconventional instruments for an album to be called Household Objects. Beginning in December 1973, the band assembled at Abbey Road Studios only to retain one usable audio snippet after 8 weeks of sessions. A sustained note produced by gliding a finger over the edge of a wine glass. It is the first sound we hear on Shine On You Crazy Diamond. Waters ditched work on Raving and Drooling and You Gotta Be Crazy and suggested the song open and close the album. He would write new material to fill the empty spaces left by the ever-present absence of Barrett. In 1974, the former cult band went back on the road as headliners. Pink Floyd premiered an early version of Shine On You Crazy Diamond live in June 1974. The song has never been released as a single, but can easily be mistaken as their biggest hit. It is recognisable and representative of the group as a whole. Broken up into nine parts over 26 minutes, Shine On You Crazy Diamond bookends and propels Wish You Were Here. The seer of visions, raver, painter, piper and prisoner imagery captures the band's collective recollection of the former bandmate. It's still very strong. This moment of sadness for them that they hadn't seen their friend for so long, Bagawa explains. That was my idea to have Roger recite the lyrics to Shine On in the film. I was a little bit scared to ask him that, but he was great. Written by Gilmour, Waters and Wright, Shine On You Crazy Diamond is an epic. The overture is cinematic. The instantly recognisable four-note guitar figure is a moving camera. The chord progression digs into blues roots for oral storytelling. Barrett was the group leader who fused little-known blues artists Pink Anderson and Floyd Dipper Boy Council into a band name and led the unit into a prog rock psychedelic sonic boom. Gilmour's guitar captures ascending aspirations, while Waters' descending bass line mourns unfulfilled promises. The progression's fourths and sixths transcend genres as much as Wright's Mini Moog and string synthesizer's Bend Time. Its closing solo floats over a passing wave of Pink Floyd's 1967 single, See Emily Play. The nod to the early hit may have dissolved into the background whirl of Reel to Reel Rewind when Barrett shuffled into Abbey Road Studios. The band was assembled in the EMI control booth, putting the final touches on the final mix of a song they'd written about him. That is a key emotional touchstone moment for all of them, Bagawa says. I can't imagine doing the song about your long-lost friend, and he just pops in. Roger says a lot of the details rely on memories which could be false memories. Storm told me Sid said, can I put some guitar down on the track? I didn't want to put stuff in the movie that couldn't be confirmed. There's so much hearsay around it. Legends loom large. And Sid did initially go unrecognised. Waters admittedly openly wept when Barrett left. Certainly, they were all emotionally affected by that, Bagawa says. They were shocked, for sure. But do the Polaroid snapshots crystallise a cultural drug casualty or a mosaic of an artist's playful self-deprecating humour? We don't see black holes in the sky when looking in Sid's eyes. We glimpse the composer of the song Bike, a curious and eager visitor to a room full of musical tunes. The image is exclusive to Ogawa's film, but he borrowed it. Phil Taylor, who's David Gilmour's guitar tech, was a Pink Floyd tour manager at the time, Ogawa says. He'd been given a camera by the band and was just learning how to use it. He had all these pictures he had taken that no one had seen. It took a lot of phone calls and emails with Phil. He was very generous in the end. He said, "Roddy, this is the one. I've been sitting on these images since 1975 thinking I might do something with them." He gave us four or five pictures. I made a promise that I wouldn't use all of them. He's got a few more. Eyewitnesses may have mixed memories of Return of a Guitar Experimentalist to the prodigal pop rock mecca, but the fact that he showed up while they were doing that song is just unbelievably uncanny, Ogawa says. It's amazing. He's there listening to the playback of that. And, like you said, it's a mythology. So, yep, Universal Music Group's content studio, Mercury Studios, they've released it already. Have you got it yet? The story of Syd Barrett and Pink Floyd. It was on in theatres on July 14th in New York, Los Angeles about 3 days ago. And it's going to be distributed globally by Abramarama. So I'm not going to have time for the scariest scenes. Because looking at the time, we have already gotten up to the first hour. I will certainly get there at some point, you know. I will get there in the end. I can give you a couple of clues, if you like, to what's in it. I'll give you some spoilers. Hellraiser and Gremlins are a couple of them. See if you can work out which ones they are. No, I'll get round to reading this at some point. Anyway, folks, we've come up to the top of the hour now. Go and get yourselves a cup of tea, cup of coffee. We'll be back after the break with the penultimate of a selection of poetry about the summer in the poetry corner. Anna Bontemps is going to be the study in the poetry corner, and then we are going to be going around the world and looking at some very beautiful places. So, see you in a bit.
Radio at freedomslips.com, and we'll be right back after this message.
I go home, people ask me, "Hey, Hoot, why do you do it, man? Why? Some kind of war junkie?" I won't say a goddamn word. Why? They won't understand. They won't understand why we do it. They won't understand it's about the men next to you. That's all it is.
Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com, number one listener supported radio, the printing press for freedom at a time when freedom is needed the most.
Transcending time and space, let us take you to the place inside your mind where thoughts divide and mysteries unwind. Join us every Monday evening right here on Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com from 8 to 10 p.m. Eastern Time, and you will catch The Fenton Perspective with our great host, Lorian Fenton. Come listen in as she shares her amazing stories from the past to present, along with all of her guest secrets to the future. That's The Fenton Perspective every Monday evening right here from 8 to 10 p.m. Eastern Time, only on Revolution Radio. Oh, and you don't need to expect us. We're already here.
If you think for one second that the Capitol will ever treat us fairly, you are lying to yourselves. Because we know who they are and what they do. This is what they do, and we must fight back. You can torture us and bomb us. Fire is catching. And if we burn, you burn with us.
Good evening.
Are you awake yet? I hope. We've tried and we've tried for years and years to use passive resistance and loud voices to make a change. That time is over. Your governments around the world have no other goal than to decimate your entire existence at the hands of the bankers and the elites. The war is coming, and it's your choice to decide if you want to be a warrior or a victim. Denial is not a choice anymore. Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com, the number one listener-supported radio station on the planet, not giving up. Revolution Radio.
Thanks for listening while we took that short break here at Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com. And now, we're going to get back to your host.
Afternoon and welcome back to the second hour of the Monday the 24th of July 2023 edition of Willow's World. This of course is the 59th anniversary of Mike Ringley's birth, and he was a big fan of Pink Floyd, by the way. And so very happy coincidence there that there was an article about Pink Floyd. But yeah, this is the second hour of Willow's World, and it's just turned 8 o'clock in the evening over here in the UK. Which means it's just turned 3 o'clock in the afternoon over on the East Coast, 2 o'clock in the afternoon Central Time, 1 o'clock in the afternoon Mountain Time, midday over on the West Coast. In Australia, it's between 5 and 7 in the morning. In New Zealand, it's 8 in the morning. But wherever you are in the world, I hope that life is being reasonably kind to you, that you're not allowing what's unfolding around the world to impact upon you too greatly. Don't let any of it do that, folks. Just ensure that that inner balance remains finely tuned, that feelings of peace, joy, compassion, love, and just don't let any of it throw you off course. And if you feel that it's doing that, if you feel any of it is doing that, then just take gentle steps to remedy it. Just take a step away, connect with nature, do something creative, artistic, take a dog, or take a dog out for a walk if you have a dog. Open the window, inhale the air. If it's not too cold, that is. If it's too cold, then just don't do that. Just, if you've got indoor plants, just do something with them. Water them, nurture them. just take whatever gentle steps you can take to restore that inner balance. And come in and join us in the chat room too. Be good to see you in there. The more, the merrier. Be good to see you. Well, you're all settling down. You've all got your teas and coffees, haven't you? Dishes of dainty delectables. You're all settled in. We're going to commence the penultimate of a selection of poetry about celebrating the summer in poetic ponderings now. And the selection today are Summer Sun by Robert Louis Stevenson, The End of the Summer by Ella Wheeler Wilcox, and Summer Glory by Annette Wynne. You settle yourselves down. We shall begin our penultimate celebration of the summer with, this is from discoverpoetry.com, this selection as well, with Summer Sun by Robert Louis Stevenson. Great is the sun, and wide he goes through empty heaven without repose. And in the blue and glowing days, more thick than rain, he showers his rays. Though closer still the blinds we pull to keep the shady parlour cool, yet he will find a chink or two to slip his golden fingers through. The dusty attic spider-clad, he through the keyhole maketh glad. And through the broken edge of tiles into the laddered hayloft smiles. Meantime, his golden face around, he bears to all the garden ground, and sheds a warm and glittering look among the ivy's inmost nook. Above the hills, along the blue, round the bright air with footing true, to please the child, to paint the rose, the gardener of the world, he goes. Next is The End of the Summer by Ella Wheeler Wilcox. The birds laugh loud and long together, when fashion's followers speed away at the first cool breath of autumn weather. Why, this is the time, cry the birds, to stay. When the deep calm sea and the deep sky over both look their passion through sun-kissed space, as a blue-eyed maid and her blue-eyed lover might gaze into the other's face. Oh, this is the time when careful spying discovers the secrets nature knows. You find when the butterflies plan for flying before the thrush or the blackbird goes, you see some day by the water's edges a brilliant border of red and black. And then off over the hills and hedges, it flutters away on the summer's track. The shy little sumacs, in lonely places, bowed all summer with dust and heat, like clean-clad children with rain-washed faces, are dressed in scarlet from head to feet. And never a flower had the boastful summer in all the blossoms that decked her sod, so royal-hued as that later comer, the purple chum of the goldenrod. Some chill grey dawn you note with grieving that the king of autumn is on his way. You see, with a sorrowful, slow believing, how the wanton woods have gone astray. They wear the stain of bold caresses, of riotous revels with old King Frost. They dazzle all eyes with their gorgeous dresses, nor care that their green young leaves are lost. A wet wind blows from the east one morning. The wood's gay garments looked draggled out. You hear a sound, and your heart takes warning. The birds are planning their winter route. They wheel and settle and scold and wrangle. Their tempers are ruffled, their voices loud. Then whir and away in a feathered tangle, to fade in the south like a passing cloud. A songless wood stripped bare of glory. A sodden moor that is black and brown. The year has finished its last love story. Oh, let us away to the gay, bright town. And finally is Annette Wynne's Summer Glory. Is it true that you are indeed the shriveled seed in spring I buried underground, not a bit of green around? Now you are full of light as a star. Out of night came this glory, grew to this little piece of perfect bliss. Oh, the joy to know I helped you grow. What mighty one would not be such small helper in such a glorious ministry? And the final three this coming Thursday. I hope to be around this Thursday. I hope to be. Might not be. We'll find out. But Summer Rain by Edmund Clarence Stedman, Early Summer by Elwood Roberts, and The Summer's Message by Annie Armstrong are the final three from this selection, which should be coming up on Thursday. Should be. Maybe. Not sure yet, because something's on. So we'll see. Now, we have plenty of time before the poetry corner commences. And I was thinking, yeah, we'll have some quotes as well. And I was thinking, what's the subject going to be today? And the word resilience came to mind. So I've looked up some quotes here on goodreads.com about resilience. Now, you're familiar with the show now. You're familiar with the format. The author, the work if applicable, and then the quote. Excuse me a minute. Just got to mute. Hold on. Back. The first is by Joseph Campbell. It's a quote about resilience. We must be willing to let go of the life we planned so as to have the life that is waiting for us. So I'll repeat that. We must be willing to let go of the life we planned so as to have the life that is waiting for us. Sophie Kinsella from The Undomestic Goddess. There's no such thing as ruining your life. Life's a pretty resilient thing, it turns out. Steve Maraboli from Life, the Truth and Being Free. Life doesn't get easier or more forgiving. We get stronger and more resilient. Robert Jordan from The Fires of Heaven. The oak fought the wind and was broken. The willow bent when it must and survived. Steve Goodyear. My scars remind me that I did indeed survive my deepest wounds. That in itself is an accomplishment. And they bring to mind something else, too. They remind me that the damage life has inflicted on me has, in many places, left me stronger and more resilient. What hurt me in the past has actually made me better equipped to face the present. Next is by Elizabeth Edwards. Resilience is accepting your new reality, even if it's less good than the one you had before. You can fight it, you can do nothing but scream about what you've lost, or you can accept that and try to put together something that's good. Germany Kent. It's a funny thing about life. Once you begin to take note of the things you are grateful for, you begin to lose sight of the things that you lack. Next is Henry Ward Beecher. Hold yourself responsible for a higher standard than anybody else expects of you. Never excuse yourself. Never pity yourself. Be a hard master to yourself and be lenient to everybody else. Eleanor Roosevelt, from You Learn by Living, 11 Keys for a More Fulfilling Life. Do the things that interest you and do them with all your heart. Don't be concerned about whether people are watching you or criticizing you. The chances are that they aren't paying any attention to you. It's your attention to yourself that is so stultifying. But you have to disregard yourself as completely as possible. If you fail the first time, then you'll just have to try harder the second time. After all, there's no real reason why you should fail. Just stop thinking about yourself. Jodi Picoult from My Sister's Keeper. The human capacity for burden is like bamboo, far more flexible than you'd ever believe at first glance. Roy T. Bennett from The Light in the Heart. What helps you persevere is your resilience and commitment. From Shane Koyjan from Blueprint for a Breakthrough from 2013. If your heart is broken, make art with the pieces. Mike Norton. Never say that you can't do something or that something seems impossible or that something can't be done, no matter how discouraging or harrowing it may be. Human beings are limited only by what we allow ourselves to be limited by, our own minds. We are each the masters of our own reality. When we become self-aware to this, absolutely anything in the world is possible. Master yourself and become king of the world around you. Let no odds, chastisement, exile, doubt, fear, or any mental viri prevent you from accomplishing your dreams. Never be a victim of life. Be its conqueror. Alain de Botton. A good half of the art of living is resilience. Gillian Flynn from Dark Places. I'm not angry or sad or happy to see you. I could not give a shit. You don't even ripple. Next is Greg Kincaid. No matter how much falls on us, we keep ploughing ahead. That's the only way to keep the roads clear. Jose N. Harris. There comes a time in your life when you walk away from all the drama and people who create it. You surround yourself with people who make you laugh. Forget the bad and focus on the good. Love the people who treat you right. Pray for the ones who do not. Life is too short to be anything but happy. Falling down is a part of life. Getting back up is living. And I'll conclude with Maya Angelou's I'll Rise. You may write me down in history with your bitter, twisted lies. You may tread me in the very dirt, but still, like dust, I'll rise. Does my sassiness upset you? Why are you beset with gloom? because I walk like I've got oil wells pumping in my living room. Just like moons and like suns, with the certainty of tides, just like hope springing high, still I'll rise. Did you want to see me broken? Bowed head and lowered eyes. Shoulders falling down like teardrops, weakened by my soulful cries. Does my haughtiness offend you? Don't you take it awful hard, because I laugh like I've got gold mines digging in my own backyard. You may shoot me with your words. You may cut me with your eyes. You may kill me with your hatefulness, but still, like air, I'll rise. Does my sexiness upset you? Does it come as a surprise that I dance like I've got diamonds at the meeting of my thighs? Out of the huts of history's shame, I rise. Up from a past that's rooted in pain, I rise. I'm a black ocean, leaping and wide, welling and swelling I bear in the tide, leaving behind nights of terror and fear, I rise. Into a daybreak that's wondrously clear, I rise. Bringing the gifts that my ancestors gave, I am the dream and the hope of the slave. I rise, I rise, I rise. I'll just share those there in the chat room for everyone to read. And you're all settled in the poetry corner. I know that. You've got your teas. Have you had a top up if you need one? Got your teas and coffees? You've had your top ups? Dishes of dainty delectables have all been topped up as well. You're all okay? All settled? It's a little bit chilly. Well, I've got some throws. Typical British summer evening, actually. cold. we're going to commence our study of today's poet here in the poetry corner. We're returning to the world of 20th century American poetry for a study of one of its most personal literary talents. He was born in October 1902 in Alexandria, Louisiana. His name was Arnaud Bonpland. He was a very notable figure in the Harlem Renaissance. Going to start with his opening paragraph from the Wikipedia, the opening paragraph from his Wikipedia page, which is literally a couple of sentences, if that. Then we're going to be heading over to poets.org for the biography of Arnaud Bonpland, after which I'll be sharing a selection of his poetry for you. But Arnaud Wendell Bonpland was born October 13th, 1902. He died on June the 4th, 1973. He was an American poet, novelist and librarian, and a noted member of the Harlem Renaissance. So I'm just going to post that there in the chat room. There we go, both of them. And heading to poets.org now for the biography. So Arnaud Wendell Bonpland was born on October 13th, 1902 in Alexandria, Louisiana, the son of a Creole bricklayer and a schoolteacher. At age three, he and his family moved to Los Angeles after his father was mortally threatened by two drunk white men. Bonpland grew up in California, was sent to the San Fernando Academy boarding school with his father's instruction to not go up there acting coloured, apparently. There's another one that I've read which says that something different, that they were relocated to Los Angeles for other reasons, but this is what this says. Bonpland later noted this as a formative moment and that he would resent what he saw as an effort to make him forget his African-American heritage. He graduated from Pacific Union College in Angwin in 1923 with a Bachelor of Arts degree. In 1924, Bonpland accepted a teaching position in Harlem, New York. He married Alberta Johnson, former student in 1926. They would eventually have six children. Now, his original plan was to obtain his PhD in English. He accepted teaching positions to support his family. While teaching in Harlem, he became closely associated to figures from the Harlem Renaissance, befriending major artists such as County McCullen, W.E.B. Du Bois, Zora Neale Hurston, James Weldon Johnson, Claude McKay, Jean Toomer, and especially Langston Hughes, with whom he frequently collaborated. Bonton first published his poems in Crisis in 1924, and also later in Opportunity, both literary magazines that supported the work of young African-American writers. In 1926 and 1927, Bonton won three prizes for his poetry from these publications. His first book of fiction was God Send Sunday, which was published in 1931. That same year, Bonton moved to Huntsville, Alabama, where he had accepted a position at Oakwood Junior College. In 1932, he received another prize for the short story A Summer Tragedy and published his first two children's books, Popo and Fifina, Children of Haiti, published in 1932 with Langston Hughes, and You Can't Pet a Possum, which was published in 1934. He began work on Black Thunder, Gabriel's Revolt, Virginia 1800, the story of an aborted rebellion by enslaved individuals led by Gabriel Prosser. The novel, published in 1936, was finished in his father's California house. At the end of the 1934 school year, Oakwood dismissed Bonton, a reaction to both his radical politics and the school's own conservative and religious views. In 1943, Bonton received a master's degree in library science from the University of Chicago. He was appointed a librarian at Fisk University, a position he held until his retirement in 1965, or I would say 66, followed by honorary degrees and professorships at the University of Illinois and Yale University, and a return to Fisk as a writer in residence. Bonton died June 4, 1973, from a heart attack while working on his autobiography. Though poet Sterling A. Brown and artist Aaron Douglas noted that his writings have not received the critical attention they deserved, Bonton's work as a librarian and historian indicate that he was a great chronicler and preserver of African-American cultural history. His family's old Louisiana home is now the Arnold Bonton African-American Museum and Cultural Arts Center. I'm just going to post those there in the chat room. Oh, that's all right. You're welcome, Dawn. You're welcome. Oh, Neil and Patrick's talking about Neil Oliver. Neil Oliver is fabulous. He's fabulous. There we go. Post those there in the chat room. So I've got to share a selection of Anna Bonton's poetry now. Let's see which ones I'm drawn to. Just making sure that's, no, it's a bit too long, that one, I think. I can always, as I say, I'm always, can always return to Anna Bonton for a later date. Homing. Sweet timberland where soft winds blow, the high green tree and fan away the fog. Fragrant stream where thirsty creatures go, and strong black men hew the heavy log. A broken house, crumbling there alone, wanting me. O silent tree, must I always be a wild bird, riding the wind and screaming bitterly? Next one I'm drawn to is The Daybreakers. We're not come to wage a strife with swords upon this hill. It is not wise to waste a life against a stubborn will. Yet we would die as some have done, beating away for the rising sun. A tree design. A tree is more than a shadow blurred against the sky, more than ink spilled on the fringe of white clouds floating by. A tree is more than an April design on a blighted winter bough, where love and music used to be. A tree is something in me, very still and lonely now. Gethsemane. All that night I walked alone and wet. I tore a rose and dropped it on the ground. My heart was lead. All that night I kept listening to hear a dreadful sound. A tree bent down and dew dripped from its hair. The earth was warm. Dawn came solemnly. I stretched full length upon the grass, and there I said your name. But silence answered me. Lancelot. The fruit of the orchard is overripe, Elaine, and leaves are crisping on the garden wall. Leaves on the garden path are wet and rain, drips from the low shrubs with a steady fall. It is long, so long since I was here, Elaine. Moles have gnawed the rose tree at its root. You did not think that I would come again, least of all in the day of falling fruit. Next is... Nocturne of the Wolves. All night they whine upon their ropes and boom against the dock with helpless prows. These little ships that are too warm for sailing front the wharf but do not rest at all. Tugging at the dim grey wharf, they think no doubt of China and of bright Bombay, and they remember islands of the east, Formosa and the mountains of Japan. They think of cities ruined by the sea, and they are restless, sleeping at the wharf. Tugging at the dim grey wharf, they think no less of Africa. An east wind blows, and salt spray sweeps the unattended decks. Shouts of dead men break upon the night. The captain calls his crew, and they respond. Little ships are dreaming. Land is near. But mist comes up to dim the copper coast. Mist disassembles images of the trees. The captain and his men alike are lost, and their shouts go down the rising sound of waves. Our little ships, I know your weariness. I know the sea-green shadows of your dream. For I have loved the cities of the sea, and desolations of the old days I have loved. I was a wanderer like you, and I have broken down before the wind. And we shall conclude with Length of Moon by Anna Bonton. Then the golden hour will tick its last, and the flame will go down in the flower. A brief length of moon will mark the sea line in the yellow June. Then we may think of this. Yet there will be something forgotten and something we should forget. It will be like all things we know. A stone will fail. A rose is sure to go. It will be quiet then, and we may stay long at the picket gate. There will be less to say. And that concludes today's study in the Poetry Corner. Anna Bontemps, who we will doubtless be returning to at some point in the future, in the Poetry Corner, or the Extended Poetry Corner on Saturdays. Anyway, folks, time to wrap ourselves up a little bit. Get our walking boots on. We're going to be visiting a few beauties around the world and also going to be going back in time to remember a beautiful body of water lost to the years. The first article is from the Get Pocket selection that comes up on Firefox's. When you open up a new tab, you know, if you've got Firefox as a browser, it'll come up with some recommended articles for you to read, and this one came up. And it's it was originally published in Afar, authored by Jen Rose Smith, and it was posted up originally back, I think, in, yeah, April 2019. And this is 11 lost cities you can actually visit. Where it says you can rediscover these abandoned cities by travelling to see their ruins, where you can readily imagine their lost to time structures and civilizations. So when the lost city of Kweneng, South Africa was discovered, it wasn't because someone found a fossil there or excavated it with a shovel. Instead, archaeologist Karim Sadir relied on LIDAR technology, which uses lasers to measure distance, to create detailed images of the surrounding Sikos Bosrand Hills, where Tswana-speaking people first built stone settlements in the 15th century. Tswana, I think. Tswana, that's it. Pronunciation. It was a slow process that spanned more than 2 years, sort of a digital version of clearing vines from a hidden temple. Sadir pored over the data, looking for patterns beneath the area's thick brush. Rounded shapes emerged on the black and white LIDAR images, helping to reconstruct the lives of families who lived in the stone homesteads, herded cattle, and created ash heaps, typically the remainders of feasts, to flaunt their wealth. While scientists had long believed that the hills held a series of small, lost-to-time communities, Sadir's finds extended far beyond the above-ground ruins already visible on the site. There was no real eureka moment, said Sadir, but it seems that one day I was looking at a collection of villages, and the next day I saw a city. Cities such as Kweneng are forgotten for a variety of reasons, and their remains have always exerted a powerful draw on inquisitive travellers. While Kweneng's visitor infrastructure isn't quite as developed yet, there are plenty of other rediscovered cities to visit. Whether you're among the dusty palaces at Xanadu or walking along ancient Troy's battlements, you can channel your inner explorer while visiting these ruins, whose cultural breadth and evocativeness show how enduring lost cities can be. The first one we're going to is Persepolis in Iran. Achaemenid Empire kings fortified a natural stone terrace into an imposing platform when they founded Persepolis in the 6th century BCE, leveraging the landscape to awe-inspiring effects and military advantage. After centuries in the sand, the delicate carvings, inscriptions and palaces of Persepolis were excavated in the 20th century. Apadana Palace dominates the oldest part of the site, where travellers will see 13 of the original 72 towering stone columns, the only survivors of a 331 BCE attack by Alexander the Great. They say here, if you travel to Iran, we recommend booking through a tour operator like Intrepid, which can help facilitate visas. Well, that may be applying for the UK, maybe something else, different somewhere else. Next up is Petra in Jordan. So the entrance to Petra is designed for maximum impact, leading visitors from a shadowy gorge to views of soaring tangerine-coloured rock. Inhabited since prehistoric times, Petra was carved by Nabataeans, who likely established it as the capital city in the 4th century BCE, and is Jordan's star attraction. It's still easy enough to find solitude in the now uninhabited desert site. ditch the tour groups by climbing a steep pathway to the high place of sacrifice. This pair of monumental obelisks are believed to represent Nabataean gods. Third is Ciudad Perdida in Colombia. Founded in the 9th century, this forest city developed a unique architectural plan of stone pathways, plazas, and houses over centuries. But dense jungle swallowed them shortly after the arrival of Europeans. A 5-day trek to Ciudad Perdida, the only way to get there, is an adventure in and of itself. Brave the steep, muddy trail to reach ceremonial terraces and to meet Colombia's indigenous Kogi and Wiwa people were some of the site's modern-day guardians and live in the region. Fourth is Pompeii and Herculaneum in Italy. Billowing ash from Mount Vesuvius dimmed the sky above Pompeii and Herculaneum in 79 CE, then buried the cities for nearly 17 centuries. While history this ancient often requires leaps of imagination, the tragic past remains eerily vivid here. Take a transporting walk through the cities, which are about a 20-minute drive apart, to see brilliant frescoes, visit the site of an ancient brothel, see the petrified bodies, and pay your respects in the Temple of Apollo. Fifth is Knossos in Greece. The Minoan palace at Knossos was already ancient when Homer wrote his Odyssey, and it has myth and history layered into its Bronze Age foundations. Archaeologist Arthur Evans began excavations for the site on Crete in 1900. He linked his findings of the remains of the palace to the mythological labyrinth where the Minotaur, a half-man, half-bull born to a Cretan queen, lurked in darkness. While that story remains unproven, travellers can judge the creature's legendary origins for themselves when visiting the palace's east wing, which is adorned with a fresco that depicts three figures and a giant vaulting bull. The sixth location is Caracol in Belize. Trees curl around Caracol stone pyramids, which the Belize jungle overtook after residents abandoned the site in the 11th century. Its architectural achievements are impressive even by modern standards. Kana, the temple complex at the heart of Caracol, remains the tallest structure in the country at 141 feet, and archaeologists believe a Maya metropolis would have dwarfed the area of today's Belize city. Rediscovered in 1938, Caracol draws far fewer visitors than nearby Tikal. Plan an early morning visit, and you might have it to yourself. Seventh is Machu Picchu in Peru. Carved high in the Andes, Machu Picchu was a fitting sanctuary for the Inca, who honoured the turbulent gods of the mountains. Emptied by the fall of the Inca Empire in the 16th century, the gorgeous synthesis of peaks and fortifications have drawn adventurers to Peru since the citadel was rediscovered in 1911. Journey to Machu Picchu by footpath, bus or luxury train, then trek to the neighbouring peak of Huayna Picchu for classic views across the main site. Eighth is Troy in Turkey. The dramatic setting for the ancient world's most consequential love triangle, Troy has a 4,000-year history that merges with myth near Turkey's Aegean coast. Discovering Troy was a driving passion for Heinrich Schliemann, an archaeologist who used Homer's Iliad like a treasure map and found the site in 1870. After you walk through the ancient fortifications and palaces here, see the troves they once held in the Troy Museum, which opened in October with interactive exhibits highlighting gleaming jewellery, marble statues, and other treasures. Next up is Ubar in Oman. As camels laden with frankincense crossed the empty quarter of the Arabian Peninsula, travellers gathered for dates and gossip at trading posts deep in the desert. Lost to the blowing sand for nearly 1,000 years, Ubar is one such site. It was found in 1992 using images taken from space. Located on the southernmost edge of Oman, Ubar is 2 hours inland from the Arabian Sea city of Sabala. Make the trip to see stone walls and fortifications that are rising from the dusty ground as excavations proceed. Penultimate is Xanadu in China. Kublai Khan ruled his empire from the city of Xanadu, surrounded by a grassland steppe that stretched to the horizon in every direction. Located about 5 hours northwest of Beijing, this is where Mongolian and Han cultures mingled, and travellers debated philosophy in gracious palaces and gardens. Find the remains of that cosmopolitan capital in Xanadu's excavated temples, stone walls and tombs, which were abandoned to the windy plains in the 15th century. And finally is El Mirador in Guatemala. Only an adventurous few will reach the ancient Maya city of El Mirador, which dates back to 1000 BCE and is shrouded by the largest tropical forest north of the Amazon. There are only two ways to get here. Charter a helicopter or trek 2 days from the road's end at the village of Carmelita. Make the journey to El Mirador to climb La Danta, a towering pyramid whose crest swells above the surrounding canopy. I'm back. Sorry. Had a little bit of indigestion then. I apologise for that. Okay, I'll post that there in the chat room. Oh, did somebody ding me? Yeah, they did, didn't they? Who do ding me? Who dinged me? Somebody dinged me, didn't they? Yeah, I know it was Dawns. I saw Dawns. You're welcome, Dawns. Welcome. Now, finally, heading to the Middle East for this one. This article is on the Atlas Obscura website, authored by Frank Jacobs, who normally also writes for Big Think as well, and it was posted up on March the 3rd this year. And we're looking at one of the beautiful, beautiful large body of water that has been lost for years and is a fraction of what it used to be. And that is the Paratethys Sea, which was once the, indeed this is the title of the article, was the largest lake in Earth's history. And the Black, Caspian and Aral Seas are the last surviving fragments of a body of water that stretched from Austria to Turkmenistan. Maps of Earth's distant past have the strange ability to shock by their sheer alienness. Consider this one showing the Paratethys Sea. It's here in the article. It's the largest lake the world has ever seen. You could have sailed from what is now Austria to what is now Turkmenistan, if there had been boats back then or people. The idea of a body of water this vast, yet now completely vanished, brings home an uncomfortable truth. The physical parameters of our world, continents and oceans, mountains and lakes, appear fixed only because our own lives are so infinitesimally short, measured against geological eras. This is great, actually, it's a fabulous map. Not much of Italy there. At all, really. There's I'm just looking. It just says there's fragments there. You can see Sicily very clearly, but Italy itself is just a slither, really. You can see we're also we can see what is going to become Britain. This is from what year is it saying? It doesn't say what year this is, roughly. It's actually a really fabulous map to look at. I'll put it in the chat room in a minute. Paratethys formed about 34 million years ago, toward the end of the Eocene epoch. It was connected to the high seas until around 12 million years ago, when the collision of the African and European tectonic plates closed it off from the Mediterranean and turned it into a self-contained lake. I'm back. Dropped out for a moment. I'm not sure why. At its largest, Paratethys had a surface area of about 2.8 million square kilometres, which is more than a million square miles, and it contained 1.77 million cubic kilometers, which is 425,000 cubic miles of water. In area, that was slightly larger than today's Mediterranean Sea, but in volume, only about a third. So, Paracelsus was a comparatively shallow sea. Still, it contained 10 times more water than all of today's lakes combined. Shallow and shut off, Paracelsus eventually started to shrink. Much of the lake evaporated between 9.8 and 7.7 million years ago, with water levels dropping by as much as 250 metres, which is 820 feet, during the most severe period, known as the Great Chersonian Drying. Losing 70% of its surface area and 30% of its volume, the Paracelsus Sea shrank to what roughly corresponds to today's Black Sea. This extreme drying turned a formerly rich and varied ecosystem, blessed with a subtropical climate for much of its existence, into a wasteland. The big salty drought killed off much of the endemic flora and fauna that developed in this closed environment over several million years, such as dwarf seals, dolphins and whales. The latter included Cetotherium riabinini, which, at just 3 metres, 10 feet, was the smallest whale species ever. One ecosystem's loss is another's gain. The desiccation and salination of the Paracelsus Sea drove a number of other species to migrate to the more welcoming plains of Africa, notably the ancestors of today's giraffes and elephants. In his doctoral dissertation, Dan Palku showed the importance of sea straits to the many catastrophes, droughts, floods and more, that befell the Paracelsus realm. Small changes in climate or in sea level can change the behaviour of the straits and then lead to environmental change and even extinction events. One example was a mega flood that temporarily transformed the Mediterranean into a brackish lake, a scenario known to earth scientists as the Lago Mare event. We conclude that sea straits are one of the most sensitive parts of our planet's plumbing, likely to disrupt the balance between seas and ocean and trigger environmental crises in the context of sea level and climate change, says Palku. What remained of a Paracelsus Sea would continue to shrink, including via a giant waterfall that poured into the Mediterranean between 6.9 and 6.7 million years ago. Various fragments, such as the Pannonian Sea, eventually disappeared. Today, the remnants of the world's largest lake are to be found in three fragments, all pretty substantial in their own right. The Black Sea, precariously connected to the open ocean via the Bosporus Strait. The Caspian Sea, which is the current holder of the world's largest lake title, and the Aral Sea, on the brink of disappearing via extreme drying, just like its ancient parent, although this time mainly due to human intervention. And there is an in-depth exploration of a Paracelsus Sea. You can read Dan Palku's dissertation if you wish, which is called The Dire Straits of Paracelsus, Dating, Matching and Modelling Connectivity Between the Miocene Seas of Eurasia. I'm not sure when that was originally posted. When that was posted, I can't see it. Oh, it's on DSpace Library. So it's a Netherlands university. Okay. Well, I'll share that there in the chat room, but that map is really rather interesting to behold. There we go. I shall share that there in the chat room. Now, I'm probably not going to start anything else because it's coming up to the top of the hour. I've got about 3 minutes, well, two and a half, just, well, probably about 2 minutes to go now before the top of the hour. So what I'm going to do, there's a couple of things I'm going to do. So I'm going to tell you what's happening on the station for the rest of the day. We'll start with this. Well, we'll stay on the studio. We'll start with the studio because I'm on it. Coming up after me at 4 p.m. Eastern will be Ro with the Crypto Corner. Following Ro at 5 p.m. will be Deacon John with Liberation Nation. Following Deacon at 6 p.m. will be Crypt Rick with I've Been Thinking. Following Rick at 8 p.m. Eastern will be Lorian Fenton with the Fenton Perspective. And rounding off the evening at 10 p.m. Eastern will be Deacon John and the Rabbit with Music Talk. Over on Studio B, the next live show will be at 6 p.m. Eastern. That'll be Mario with This, That and the Other. Following Mario at 8 p.m. will be Scott McKay with The Tipping Point. And rounding off the evening at 10 p.m. Eastern will be Robert Morningstar with The Right Stuff. And I'll be back with you, hopefully on Thursday, because there might be something on Thursday. I might need to, might need an evening off. I'm not sure at this point. But if not, then I'll be here on Thursday as normal, 2 p.m. Eastern, on this very studio. Starting the first hour with Geek Headlines. Spiritual Matters, where we're going to be studying the topic of dreams, particularly those which herald life transitions. Final selection of that selection of poetry celebrating the summer is going to be happening in Poetic Ponderings on Thursday. We're heading back to the world of 19th century British poetry in the Poetry Corner for... Oh, hang on a minute. There's something I need to do here which before I forget about it. What have you suddenly done that for? Anyway, yeah, we're returning to the world of 19th century British poetry for a study of one of its most pastoral and highly respected of literary leviathans on Thursday. He was born in July 1793 in Helpston, Northamptonshire. His name is John Clare, and indeed I have featured his works before. And then we're going to be starting a new segment, putting our aprons on and heading into the kitchen for a first serving of a new segment called Willow's Cookery Corner. We'll find out more about on Thursday. So anyway... Reached the end of the show. Going to hand you over to Ro now. You all take care. You have a lovely couple of days. Hopefully see you next day. Take care.
Natural law. You enjoy interviews with amazing guests? Then join Crypt Rick every Monday night, 6 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, right here on Revolution Radio. Studio A, freedomslips.com. Crypt Rick's iPhone banking. Welcome to the Crypt.
It is no secret that the so-called mainstream media is best described as controlled propaganda. Countless news stories are either totally ignored or spun with half-truths, and because of this, essential facts and vital information are often compromised. Join Dr. Ott every Friday night on Studio B at 10 p.m. Eastern and learn why The Story Behind the Story was nominated for a Peabody Award in its second year of producing unparalleled broadcasting excellence in 1997. That is, if you really care about learning the truth.